Happy New Year to my readers. I'm Elaine Charles, and I want to welcome you to the first book report of the year. That's 2011. Let's all start repeating that number so we get used to saying it. 2011. Wow. Since this is the first weekend of the new year, I thought we would theme this show around firsts. The titles topping all the big lists from the New York Times bestsellers, Amazon, and others. After all, we readers like to check what's new and notable from time to time to see if our favorites correspond with the pros, what the national critics are saying. So settle in now for a bit of our literary look at firsts. We'll start right after this.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need MagicBuzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The MagicBuzz team makes sure our clients are well-represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. MagicBuzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at MagicBuzz.com. MagicBuzz.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@MagicBuzz.com. MagicBuzz. We're there when you can't be.
Listeners, we're going to jump right in at the top. If Letterman can do his top 10 list, Elaine Charles can do her top 10 list. But first, as a former Library of Congress staffer, let's quote another respected source as a reference point. Readers, here is the top 10 list of 2010 from the editors at Amazon.com. Number one, and topping the list, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks by Rebecca Skloot. From a single short life grew a seemingly immortal line of cells that made some of the most crucial innovations in modern science possible. From that life, Skloot fashions a rich and haunting story that redefines what it means to have a medical history, and we're going to preview that book later on in the show. Number two, Faithful Place, a novel by Tanya French. The past haunts in French novels. In this compelling mystery, Frank Mackey, the beloved undercover guru from The Likeness, returns home to investigate the cold case of his teenage sweetheart and faces down his family. Number three, Matterhorn, a novel of the Vietnam War by Carl Marlantes. A breathtaking debut, 30 years in the making, by a decorated Vietnam vet that takes readers deep into the jungle and offers a new perspective on the ravages of war, the bureaucracy of the military, and the peculiar beauty of brotherhood. Number four, and a title that we've reviewed before, Unbroken, a World War II story of survival, resilience, and redemption by Lauren Hillenbrand. As she did with Seabiscuit, Hillenbrand has unearthed another unlikely and inspiring tale from our past. Louis Zamperini was an Olympic athlete as a teenager, an airman in World War II, an ocean crash survivor, and a prisoner of war before returning home for another half century of life. Number five, The Warmth of Other Suns, the epic story of America's Great Migration by Isabel Wilkerson. Through the eyes of three families, Wilkerson gives vivid life to one of the great untold epics of American history, the migration between the two world wars of millions of African Americans from the South to the North and the West. Number six, Freedom, a novel by Jonathan Franzen. Franzen's first novel since The Corrections is a wrenchingly funny and forgiving portrait of a Midwestern family. Freedom is deserving of all the attention it has received this summer. Number seven, The Girl Who Kicked the Hornet's Nest by Stieg Larsson. The finest example of a book that saves the best for last, The Girl Who Kicked the Hornet's Nest roars with an explosive storyline filled with revelations that make the end of this game-changing suspense series all the more bittersweet. Number 8, To the End of the Land by David Grossman. In a fictional story whose events hauntingly parallel the author's own life, an Israeli mother goes on a journey through her past to avoid the news that her soldier son may have been killed. Just Kids is number 9 by Patti Smith. Smith and Robert Mapplethorpe weren't always famous, but they always thought they would be. Smith's memoir of their friendship is tender and artful, with the visionary style of her rock anthems balanced by her detailed memories of their bohemian youth. Number 10, and last on our list, The Big Short, Inside the Doomsday Machine by Michael Lewis. Of the many books about our economic meltdown, The Big Short is the one to read, told in Lewis's usual hilarious and clear style, from the perspective of a few iconoclastic thinkers who saw the collapse coming and bet big on it. Okay, that was Amazon's list. And here is the Elaine Charles top 10 of books we previewed together on the show. And by the way, readers, I'd love for you to share your top reads of the year. Drop me a line with your top titles up to 3 at elaine@bookreportradio.com. I'll be featuring some of your choices in upcoming shows. So, without further ado, the Elaine Charles top 10 list. Number 1, I love this book, Room by Emma Donoghue. Number 2, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo by Stieg Larsson. Number 3, War by Sebastian Junger. Number 4, Life by Keith Richards. Number 5, Medium Raw by Anthony Bourdain, A Bloody Valentine to the World of Food and the People Who Cook. Number 6, At Home by Bill Bryson. Number 7, From My Pal, Dave Barry, I'll Mature When I'm Dead. Number 8, Unbroken by Laura Hillenbrand. Number 9, A Dog's Purpose, A Novel for Humans by W. Bruce Cameron. And number 10, American on Purpose by Craig Ferguson. Okay, now it's time to start looking ahead. Let's check in with Tom Neasley, Senior Editor of Books at Amazon.com. He'll share with us the why and wherefore of their top 10 list for the month of January. Welcome, Tom. So glad you could join us today. Let's get right to it. Would you please share with our listeners the list for the month of January?
Sure. Well, our spotlight pick, our favorite book of the month for January, is Salinger, A Life by Kenneth Solinsky. Then we have a novel by Eleanor Brown called The Weird Sisters, The Empty Family, a collection of stories by Colm Tobin, The Lover's Dictionary, another quirky little novel by David Levithan, The Hidden Reality, a new physics book by Brian Greene, The Longest War, a book about the fight against terrorism by Peter Bergen, and Poser, a book about yoga, life, marriage, and children by Claire Dieterer.
Well, our readers will want to know about your group and how you come to consensus on the list.
Yeah, consensus might be a little strong because there's a lot of opinions in our group. But we are a bunch of readers, a lot of whom write for the Amazon.com books website and our blog, Omnivoracious, and we just start reading books a month or two ahead of time. We're lucky enough to get early copies, and then we start reading and arguing and passing around the ones we like the most, and we're still talking up until the deadline.
And how long does that process take, actually?
Well, we're reading for a long time, but once we start talking, it's a few weeks, and, you know, we meet every so often and talk over email and try to come to some kind of agreement.
Are all of your colleagues in a room together, or you do this all, you know, over the net, or?
Both. We'll get in a room once in a while, and that helps, but often we it spills over, and we're these long email threads about books we liked or didn't like or disagree about.
And how many in the group, actually?
There's about a dozen voices who are all reading and arguing.
And is it usual, for example, that your top title, there's a lot of consensus and or is it tooth and nail, you know, discussion on every list there?
It can go either way. Sometimes there's a book for our best of the year list last year, which can often be very contentious. We picked The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, and that was almost unanimous. That was a book that we had passed around and loved the whole year long.
Actually, I previewed that book on the show because I did reference your best of the year list on the show. So,
great.
When does the book actually have to be published for it to be the best of the month of January? Must it come out in the month of December, or what's the time frame there?
We tend to focus on books that either come out that month or a week or so beforehand. A lot of, especially after the holidays, some of these books actually come out at the very end of December, but I think publishers and readers consider them January books. So these ones come out, I think, anytime from late December to late January.
What kind of feedback do you get from readers on your list?
On our blog, we get comments from readers. My favorite comment, again, about our Best of the Year list was someone who wrote in and said, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks is the best book he's read in 59 years of reading, which was the best kind of thing we can hear.
Well, Tom, since Salinger made the top of the list, can you talk a little bit more about that specific title?
Sure. Well, as readers know, J.D. Salinger died just about a year ago, and he has been one of the great biographical nuts to crack. That he obviously lived a very secluded life. People who have, you know, someone who tried to write a biography about him, it ended up being called In Search of Salinger because he couldn't get to the man himself. But this is written by Kenneth Slowinski, who is a huge fan. He's not a traditional biographer. He's, I think, had a great website about Salinger, and he really seems to have gotten inside Salinger. And I think one thing he does really well is connect his stories and his novels, which everybody knows are often quite autobiographical, to the man himself.
Hmm. All right. Well, thank you so much, Tom. Readers, check out the list at amazon.com/bestbooks. Thanks again.
Social media. It's got everyone buzzing these days. But what is it really? And how can you put it to work for you? More than just a passing trend that's hot today, gone tomorrow. Social media is marketing that is making a difference for savvy business people who have jumped into the future. Magic Buzz is a new online marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media like Facebook and Twitter together with the viral reach power of YouTube to create the socio-viral effect. Magic Buzz's socio-viral solution provides the measurable value of online advertising that works, affordable, and effective. So get the buzz going for your business. Magic Buzz, with only one Z, because we're never asleep. Visit us at magicbuz.com. For more information or any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
Her name was Henrietta Lacks, but scientists know her as Hella. She was a poor southern tobacco farmer who worked the same land as her slave owners, yet her cells, taken without her knowledge, became one of the most important tools in medicine. In The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, author Rebecca Skloot tells the story of the first immortal human cells grown in culture. They are still alive today, though Henrietta has been dead for more than 60 years. If you could pile all of the HeLa cells ever grown onto a scale, they'd weigh more than 50 million metric tons. That's as much as 100 Empire State Buildings. HeLa cells were vital for developing the polio vaccine, uncovered secrets of cancer viruses, and the atomic bomb effects. And they helped lead to important advances like in vitro fertilization, cloning, and gene mapping. These cells have been bought and sold by the billions, yet Henrietta Lacks remains virtually unknown, buried in an unmarked grave. Now, Rebecca Skloot, a science journalist, takes us on an extraordinary journey from the colored ward of Johns Hopkins Hospital in the 1950s to laboratories with freezers full of HeLa cells. From Henrietta's small, dying hometown of Clover, Virginia, a land of wooden slave quarters, faith healings, and voodoo, to East Baltimore today, where her children and grandchildren live and struggle with the legacy of her cells. Henrietta's family did not learn of her immortality until more than 20 years after her death, when scientists investigating HeLa began using her husband and children in research without informed consent. And though the cells launched a million-dollar industry that sells human biological materials, her family never saw any of the profits. As Skloot so brilliantly shows, the story of the Lax family, past and present, is connected to the dark history of experimentation on African Americans, the birth of bioethics, and the legal battle over whether we control the stuff we are made of. The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks is a critical exploration of the interplay between science, race, class, and ethics in the United States. Let's listen.
There's a photo on my wall of a woman I've never met. Its left corner torn and patched together with tape. She looks straight into the camera and smiles, hands on hips, dress suit neatly pressed, lips painted deep red. It's the late 1940s, and she hasn't yet reached the age of 30. Her light brown skin is smooth, her eyes still young and playful, oblivious to the tumor growing inside her. A tumor that would leave her five children motherless and change the future of medicine. Beneath the photo, a caption says her name is Henrietta Lacks, Helen Lane, or Helen Larson. No one knows who took that picture, but it's appeared hundreds of times in magazines and science textbooks, on blogs and laboratory walls. She's usually identified as Helen Lane, but often she has no name at all. She's simply called Hela, the code name given to the world's first immortal human cells, her cells, cut from her cervix just months before she died. Her real name is Henrietta Lacks. I've spent years staring at that photo, wondering what kind of life she led, what happened to her children, and what she'd think about cells from her cervix living on forever. Bought, sold, packaged, and shipped by the trillions to laboratories around the world. I've tried to imagine how she'd feel knowing that her cells went up in the first space missions to see what would happen to human cells in zero gravity, or that they helped with some of the most important advances in medicine, the polio vaccine, chemotherapy, cloning, gene mapping, in vitro fertilization. I'm pretty sure that she, like most of us, would be shocked to hear that there are trillions more of her cells growing in laboratories now than there ever were in her body. There's no way of knowing exactly how many of Henrietta's cells are alive today. One scientist estimates that if you could pile all Hela cells ever grown onto a scale, they'd weigh more than 50 million metric tons, an inconceivable number, given that an individual cell weighs almost nothing. Another scientist calculated that if you could lay all Hela cells ever grown end to end, they'd wrap around the Earth at least three times, spanning more than 350 million feet. In her prime, Henrietta herself stood only a bit over 5 feet tall. I first learned about Hela cells and the woman behind them in 1988, 37 years after her death, when I was 16 and sitting in a community college biology class. My instructor, Donald Deffler, a gnomish balding man, paced at the front of the lecture hall and flipped on an overhead projector. He pointed to two diagrams that appeared on the wall behind him. They were schematics of the cell reproduction cycle, but to me, they just looked like a neon-colored mess of arrows, squares, and circles with words I didn't understand, like MPF triggering a chain reaction of protein activations. I was a kid who'd failed freshman year at the regular public high school because she never showed up. I'd transferred to an alternative school that offered dream studies instead of biology, so I was taking Deffler's class for high school credit, which meant that I was sitting in a college lecture hall at 16 with words like mitosis and kinase inhibitors flying around. I was completely lost. "Do we have to memorize everything on those diagrams?" one student yelled. "Yes," Deffler said. "We had to memorize the diagrams, and yes, they'd be on the test, but that didn't matter right then." What he wanted us to understand was that cells are amazing things. There are about 100 trillion of them in our bodies, each so small that several thousand could fit on the period at the end of this sentence.
John Grisham is an author who's been topping bestseller lists for years, and his latest title, The Confession, a novel, is yet another chart topper. An innocent man is about to be executed. Only a guilty man can save him. In 1998, Travis Boyette abducted, raped, and strangled a popular high school cheerleader in a small East Texas town. Then Travis watches as police and prosecutors go after the wrong man, Dante Drum, a local football star. Travis sees Dante sent to prison, serve hard time, and face execution. Fast forward 9 years since that heinous crime. Travis has been paroled in Kansas for yet a different crime. But back in Texas, the unjustly accused Dante is 4 days away from his execution. The twist? Travis is suffering from an inoperable brain tumor. For the first time in his miserable life, he decides to do the right thing and confess. But can a guilty man convince lawyers, judges, and politicians they're about to execute an innocent man? Readers across the country have found this page-turner one of their favorites. Let's listen as Scott Sowers narrates.
Okay, I'll take some basic information and we'll see what can be done. Her pen was ready. Thank you, he said, bowing slightly. Name? Travis Boyette. He instinctively spelled his last name for her. Date of birth, October 10, 1963. Place, Joplin, Missouri. Age, 44. Single, divorced, no children. No address, no place of employment, no prospects. Dana absorbed this as her pen frantically searched for the proper blanks to be filled. His response created far more questions than her little form was designed to accommodate. Okay, about the address, she said, still writing. Where are you staying these days? These days I'm the property of the Kansas Department of Corrections. I'm assigned to a halfway house on 17th Street, a few blocks from here. I'm in the process of being released. Reentry, as they like to call it. A few months in a halfway house here in Topeka. Then I'm a free man with nothing to look forward to but parole for the rest of my life. The pen stopped moving, but Dana stared at it anyway. Her interest in the inquiry had suddenly lost steam. She was hesitant to ask anything more. However, since she had started the interrogation, she felt compelled to press on. What else were they supposed to do while they waited on the minister? Would you like some coffee? She asked. Certain that the question was harmless. There was a pause, much too long, as if he couldn't decide. Yes, thanks. Just black with a little sugar. Dana scurried from the room and went to find coffee. He watched her leave, watched everything about her, noticed the nice round backside under the everyday slacks, the slender legs, the athletic shoulders, even the ponytail. 5'3", maybe 4", 110 pounds max. She took her time, and when she returned, Travis Boyette was right where she'd left him, still sitting monk-like, the fingertips of his right hand gently tapping those of his left, his black wooden cane across his thighs, his eyes gazing forlornly at nothing on the far wall. His head was completely shaved, small and perfectly round and shiny. And as she handed him the cup, she pondered the frivolous question of whether he'd gone bald at an early age or simply preferred the skinned look. There was a sinister tattoo creeping up the left side of his neck. He took the coffee and thanked her for it. She resumed her position with the desk between them. "Are you Lutheran?" she asked, again with the pen. "I doubt it. I'm nothing, really. Never saw the need for church." But you were here yesterday. Why? Boyette held the cup with both hands at his chin like a mouse nibbling on a morsel. If a simple question about coffee took a full 10 seconds, then one about church attendance might require an hour. He sipped, licked his lips. How long do you think it'll be before I can see the Reverend? he finally asked. Not soon enough, Dana thought, anxious now to pass this one along to her husband. She glanced at a clock on the wall and said, "Any minute now." "Would it be possible just to sit here in silence as we wait?" he asked, with complete politeness. Dana absorbed the stiff arm and quickly decided that silence wasn't a bad idea. Then her curiosity returned. "Sure, but one last question." She was looking at the questionnaire as if it required one last question. "How long were you in prison?" she asked. "Half my life," Boyette said with no hesitation, as if he fielded that one 5 times a day. Dana scribbled something, and then the desktop keyboard caught her attention. She pecked away with a flourish as if suddenly facing a deadline. Her email to Keith read, "There's a convicted felon out here who says he must see you. Not leaving until. Seems nice enough. Having coffee. Let's wrap things up back there." 5 minutes later, the pastor's door opened and a young woman escaped through it. She was wiping her eyes. She was followed by her ex-fiancé, who managed both a frown and a smile at the same time. Neither spoke to Dana. Neither noticed Travis Boyette.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well-represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. MagicBuzz.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz. We're there when you can't be.
Readers, we've talked a lot about the phenomenal success of the Millennium Trilogy. Author Stieg Larsson was a crusading Swedish journalist committed to fighting political extremism and racism in his home country. Just before his untimely death in 2004, he completed a trilogy of striking crime novels. We've previewed books 1 and 3 last year on the show, so let's complete the trilogy and delve into number 2, The Girl Who Played with Fire. The story shifts focus onto the socially awkward computer hacker Lisbeth Salander, who becomes entangled in an investigation into sex trafficking, murder, and corruption. Lisbeth is a clenched fist of a character, difficult, psychologically traumatized, and capable of extreme violence. I know I hadn't met a more original character in quite some time. Simon Vance, one of my guests last year, delivers an amazing performance. Let's listen.
He stood at the foot of the bed and observed her for a long time. She hated his silence. She could see him only in silhouette from the light in the doorway. Then he spoke to her. He had a dark, clear voice that stressed pedantically each word. She hated his voice. He told her that it was her birthday, and he wanted to wish her happy birthday. His tone was not unfriendly or ironical. It was neutral. She thought that he was smiling. She hated him. He came closer and went around to the head of the bed. He laid the back of a moist hand on her forehead and ran his fingers along her hairline in a gesture that was probably intended to be friendly. It was his birthday present to her. She hated his touch. She saw his mouth move, but she shut out the sound of his voice. She did not want to listen. She did not want to answer. She heard him raise his voice, a hint of irritation at her failure to respond. He talked about mutual trust. After a few minutes he stopped. She ignored his gaze, Then he shrugged and began adjusting her leather straps. He tightened the harness across her chest a bit and leaned over her. She twisted suddenly to the left, away from him, as abruptly as she could and as far as the straps would allow. She pulled up her knees to her chin and kicked hard at his head. She aimed at his Adam's apple, and the tip of her toe hit him somewhere below his jaw, but he was ready for that and turned away, so it was only a light blow. She tried to kick again, but he was out of reach. She let her legs sink back down onto the bed. The sheet slid down onto the floor. Her nightdress had slid up above her hips. He stood still for a long time without saying a word. Then he walked around the bed and tightened the foot restraint. She tried to pull her legs up, but he grabbed hold of one ankle, forced her knee down with his other hand, and fastened her foot with a leather strap. He went around the bed and tied down her other foot. Now she was utterly helpless. He picked up the sheet from the floor and covered her. He watched her in silence for 2 minutes. She could sense his excitement in the dark, even though he did not show it. He undoubtedly had an erection. She knew that he would reach out and touch her. Then he turned and left, closing the door behind him. She heard him bolt it, which was totally unnecessary, because she had no way of getting free from the bed. She lay for several minutes, looking at the narrow strip of light over the door. Then she moved and tried to feel how tight the straps were. She could pull her knees up a bit, but the harness and the foot restraints grew taut immediately. She relaxed. She lay still, staring at nothing. She waited. She thought about a gasoline can and a match. She saw him drenched with gasoline. She could actually feel the box of matches in her hand. She shook it. It rattled. She opened the box and selected a match. She heard him say something, but she shut her ears, did not listen to the words. She saw the expression on his face as she moved the match towards the striking surface. She heard the scraping sound of sulphur. It sounded like a drawn-out thunderclap. She saw the match burst into flame. She smiled a hard smile and steeled herself. It was her 13th birthday. Part 1. Irregular Equations. December 16th to 20th. Equations are classified by the highest power value of the exponent of their unknowns. If this is 1, the equation is of first degree. If this is 2, the equation is of second degree, and so on. Equations of higher degree than 1 yield multiple possible values for their unknown quantities. These values are known as roots.
I believe there is another man inside every man, a stranger, writes Wilfred Leland James in the early pages of the riveting confession that makes up 1922, the first in Stephen King's pitch-black quartet of mesmerizing tales entitled Full Dark, No Stars. For James, that stranger is awakened when his wife, Arlette, proposes selling off the family homestead and moving to Omaha, setting in motion a gruesome train of murder and madness. In Big Driver, a cozy mystery writer named Tess encounters a stranger along a back road in Massachusetts when she takes a shortcut home. Violated and left for dead, Tess plots a revenge that will bring her face to face with another stranger, the one inside herself. Fair Extension, the shortest of these tales, is perhaps the nastiest and the most humorous. Making a deal with the devil not only saves Dave Streeter from a fatal cancer, but provides rich recompense for a lifetime of resentment. When her husband of more than 20 years is away on one of his business trips, Darcy Anderson looks for batteries in the garage. Her toe knocks up against a box under a work table, and she discovers the stranger inside her husband. It's a horrifying discovery, rendered with bristling intensity, and brings to end what she had considered a good marriage. Stephen King believes American readers should pay more attention to the virtues of short fiction. And, according to the publication Booklist, if anyone can get reluctant short story and novella readers into the swing, he certainly can with this book. Readers, if you've never read a King book, they can really surprise you. I know I had shied away from Stephen King. I thought he only wrote horror stories, which is not my cup of tea. But then a friend recommended I read Hearts in Atlantis, and it is, I have to tell you, one of my all-time favorites. I now know that many of King's stories, though full of suspense, sometimes creepy suspense, are about ordinary people faced with extraordinary circumstances. Let's listen as Craig Watson and Jessica Hecht narrate.
I believe that there is another man inside of every man, a stranger, a conniving man. And I believe that by March of 1922, when the Hemingford County skies were white and every field was a snow-scrimmed mudsuck, the conniving man inside Farmer Wilfred James had already passed judgment on my wife and decided her fate. 'Twas justice of the black cap variety, too. The Bible says that an ungrateful child is like a serpent's tooth, but a nagging and ungrateful wife is ever so much sharper than that. I am not a monster. I tried to save her from the conniving man. I told her that if we could not agree, she should go to her mother's in Lincoln, which is 60 miles west, a good distance for a separation, which is not quite a divorce, yet signifies a dissolving of the marital corporation. And leave you my father's land, I suppose, she asked, and tossed her head. How I had come to hate that pert head toss, so like that of an ill-trained pony, and the little sniff which always accompanied it. That will never happen, Wilf. I told her that I would buy the land from her if she insisted. It would have to be over a period of time, 8 years, perhaps 10, but I would pay her every cent. A little money coming in is worse than none, she replied, with another sniff and head toss. This is something every woman knows. The Farrington Company will pay all at once, and their idea of top dollar is apt to be far more generous than yours. And I will never live in Lincoln. 'Tis not a city, but only a village with more churches than houses. Do you see my situation? Do you not understand the spot she put me in? Can I not count on at least a little of your sympathy? No? Then hear this. In early April of that year, 8 years to this very day, for all I know, she came to me all bright and shining. She had spent most of the day at the beauty salon in McCook, and her hair hung around her cheeks in fat curls that reminded me of the toilet rolls one finds in hotels and inns. She said she'd had an idea. It was that we should sell the 100 acres and the farm to the Farrington Combine. She believed they would buy it all, just to get her father's piece, which was near the railway line, and she was probably right. Then, said this saucy vixen, we can split the money, divorce, and start new lives apart from each other. We both know that's what you want. As if she didn't. Ah, I said, as if giving the idea serious consideration. And with which of us does the boy go? Me, of course, she said, wide-eyed. A boy of 14 needs to be with his mother. I began to work on Henry that very day, telling him his mother's latest plan. We were sitting in the haymow. I wore my saddest face and spoke in my saddest voice, painting a picture of what his life would be like if his mother was allowed to carry through with this plan. How he would have neither farm nor father, how he would find himself in a much bigger school, all his friends, most since babyhood, left behind, How, once in that new school, he would have to fight for a place among strangers who would laugh at him and call him a country bumpkin. On the other hand, I said, if we could hold on to all the acreage, I was convinced we could pay off our note at the bank by 1925 and live happily, debt-free, breathing sweet air, instead of watching pig guts float down our previously clear stream from sunup to sundown. Now, what is it you want? I asked, after drawing this picture in as much detail as I could manage. To stay here with you, Papa, he said. Tears were streaming down his cheeks.
Social media. It's got everyone buzzing these days. But what is it, really? And how can you put it to work for you? More than just a passing trend that's hot today, gone tomorrow, social media is marketing that is making a difference for savvy business people who have jumped into the future. Magic Buzz is a new online marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media like Facebook and Twitter together with the viral reach power of YouTube to create the socio-viral effect. Magic Buzz's socio-viral solution provides the measurable value of online advertising that works, affordable, and effective. So get the buzz going for your business. Magic Buzz, with only one Z, because we're never asleep. Visit us at magicbuz.com. For more information or any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
Here's a mystery that's topped most everyone's list at year end. Let's take a trip to Baker Street for a book about everyone's favorite cape-wearing, pipe-smoking detective. Author Graham Moore weaves a fascinating tale, the Sherlockian. In December 1893, Sherlock Holmes fans eagerly opened their Strand magazines, anticipating the detective's next adventure, only to find the unthinkable. His creator, Arthur Conan Doyle, had killed off their hero. London spiraled into mourning and railed against Conan Doyle as his assassin. Then, in 1901, just as abruptly as Conan Doyle had murdered Holmes in The Final Problem, he resurrected him. Though the writer kept detailed diaries of his days and work, Conan Doyle never explained this sudden change of heart. After his death, one of his journals from the interim period was discovered to be missing, and in the decades since has never been found. Or has it? When literary researcher Harold White is inducted into the preeminent Holmes Enthusiast Society, the Baker Street Irregulars, he never imagines he's about to be thrust onto the hunt for the holy grail of Sherlockians, the missing diary. But when the world's leading Conan Doyle scholar is found murdered in his hotel room, it is Harold, using wisdom and methods gleaned from the countless detective stories, who takes up the search both for the diary and for the killer. Will the mystery be solved? It's elementary, my dear listeners. Here is James Langton narrating.
So please grip this fact with your cerebral tentacle. The doll and its maker are never identical. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, London Opinion, December 12, 1912. August 9, 1893. Arthur Conan Doyle curled his brow tightly and thought only of murder. I'm going to kill him, Conan Doyle said as he folded his arms across his broad frame. High in the Swiss Alps, the air tickled Arthur's inch-thick moustache and seemed to blow straight through his ears. Set far back on his head, Arthur's ears always appeared to be perking up, listening to something else, something distant and behind him. For such a stocky man, he had a nose that was remarkably sharp. His hair had only recently begun to grey, a process that Arthur couldn't help but wish along. Though he was but 33 years of age, he was already a celebrated author. An internationally acclaimed man of letters with light ochre hair would not do so well as a wizened one now, would he? Arthur's two travelling companions ascended to the ledge on which he stood, the highest climbable point of the Reichenbach Falls. Silas Hocking was a cleric and novelist, well known as far away as Arthur's London, His recent offering of religious literature, Her Benny, was a work Arthur held in high regard. Edward Benson was an acquaintance of Hocking's and was much quieter than his gregarious friend. Though Arthur had met the two men only this morning over breakfast at the Riffel Alp Hotel in Zermatt, he felt that he could confide in them safely. He could tell them of his mind and of his dark plans.
"The fact is, he has gotten to be a kind of old man of the sea about my neck," continued Arthur, "and I intend to make an end of him."
Hocking huffed as he stood beside Arthur, gazing at the vast expanse of the Alps before them. Tufts of snow melted yards beneath their feet into a mighty stream of water that had, millennia ago, driven a path through the mountain as it poured loudly into the frothing pool below. Benson silently pressed a mittenful of snow into a tight ball and dropped it whimsically into the chasm. The force of the wind tore bits off the snowball as it fell until it disappeared in the air as a series of white puffs.
"If I don't," said Arthur, "he'll make a death of me."
"Don't you think you're being rather rough on an old friend?" asked Hocking. "He's given you fame, fortune. You two have made a handsome couple.
And I'm plastering his name across every penny dreadful in London. I've given him a reputation which far exceeds my own. You know, I get letters. My beloved cat has vanished into South Hampstead. Her name is Sherry Ann. Can you find her? Or, my mum had her purse snatched exiting a hansom in Piccadilly. Can you deduce the culprit?"
"But the thing of it is, the letters aren't addressed to me. They're addressed to him.
They think he's real."
"Yes, your poor admiring readers," pleaded Hocking. "Have you thought of them? People seem so terribly fond of the fellow."
"More fond of him than of me. Do you know, I received a letter from my own mam. She asked, knowing I would of course do anything she ever required, she asked that I sign the name Sherlock Holmes to a book for her neighbour Beatty. Can you imagine? Sign his name rather than my own? My mam speaks as if she's Holmes's mother, not mine. Gah!"
Arthur tried to contain his sudden burst of anger.
"My greater work is ignored," he continued. "Micah Clarke, The White Company? That charming little play I concocted with Mr. Barry, overlooked for a few morbid yarns."
Three ordinary women are about to take one extraordinary step. And The Help, the bestseller by Catherine Stockett, makes you want to follow them every step of the way. 22-year-old Skeeter has just returned home after graduating from Ole Miss. She may have a degree, but it's 1962 in Mississippi, and her mother will not be happy till Skeeter has a ring on her finger. Skeeter would normally find solace with her beloved maid, Constantine, the woman who raised her, but Constantine has disappeared, and no one will tell Skeeter where she's gone. Abilene is an African-American maid, a wise, regal woman raising her 17th white child. Something has shifted inside her after the loss of her own son, who died while his bosses looked the other way. She is devoted to this little girl she looks after, though she knows both their hearts may be broken. Minnie, Abilene's best friend, is perhaps the sassiest woman in Mississippi. She can cook like nobody's business, but she can't mind her tongue, so she's lost yet another job. Minnie finally finds a position working for someone too new in town to know about her reputation, but her new boss has secrets of her own. Seemingly as different from one another as anyone can be, these women will nonetheless come together for a project that will put them all at risk. Why? Because they are suffocating within the lines that define their town and their times. Sometimes lines are made to be crossed. Catherine Stockett creates three extraordinary women whose determination to start a movement of their own forever changes a town and the way women, mothers, daughters, caregivers, and friends view one another.
Lord, it made me proud. But one night he working late at the Scanlon Taylor Mill, lugging 2x4s to the truck. Splinters slicing all the way through the glove. He too small for that kind of work, too skinny, but he needed the job. He was tired, it was raining. He slipped off the loading dock, fell down on the drive. Tractor trailer didn't see him, and crushed his lungs before he could move. By the time I found out, he was dead. That was the day my whole world went black. Air looked black. Sun looked black. I laid up in bed and stared at the black walls of my house. Many came every day to make sure I was still breathing, feed me food to keep me living. Took 3 months before I even look out the window, see the world still there. I was surprised to see the world didn't stop just 'cause my boy did. 5 months after the funeral, I lifted myself up out of bed. I put on my white uniform and put my little gold cross back around my neck. And I went to wait on Miss Leafolt, 'cause she just have her baby girl. But it weren't too long before I seen something in me had changed. A bitter seed was planted inside of me. And I just didn't feel so accepting anymore. Get the house straightened up and then go on and fix some of that chicken salad now, say Miss Leafolt. It's Bridge Club Day. Every fourth Wednesday of the month. Of course, I already got everything ready to go. Made the chicken salad this morning. Ironed the tablecloths yesterday. Miss Leafolt seen me at it, too. She ain't but 23 years old, and she like hearing herself tell me what to do. She already got the blue dress on I ironed this morning. The one with 65 pleats on the waist. So tiny I got to squint through my glasses to iron. I don't hate much in life, but me and that dress is not on good terms. And you make sure Mae Mobley's not coming in on us now. I tell you, I am so burned up at her. Tore up my good stationery into 5,000 pieces, and I've got 15 thank you notes for the Junior League to do. I arranged the this and the that for her lady friends. Set out the good crystal, put the silver service out. Miss Leafolt don't put up no dinky card table like the other ladies do. We sat at the dining room table. Put a cloth on top to cover the big L-shaped crack. Move that red flower centerpiece to the sideboard to hide where the wood all scratched. Miss Leafolt, she like it fancy when she do a luncheon. Maybe she trying to make up for her house being small. They ain't rich folk, that I know. Rich folk don't try so hard. I'm used to working for young couples, but I expect this is the smallest house I ever worked in. It's just the one story. Her and Mr. Leafolt's room in the back be a fair size, but baby girl's room be tiny. The dining room and the regular living room kind of join up. Only two bathrooms, which is a relief, 'cause I worked in houses where they was five or six. Take a whole day just to clean toilets. Miss Leafolt don't pay but 95 cents an hour, less than I've been paid in years.
Nora Ephron returns with her first book since the astounding success of I Feel Bad About My Neck. And in I Remember Nothing, she takes a cold, hard, hilarious look at the past, the present, and the future. She bemoans the vicissitudes of modern life and recalls with her signature clarity and wisdom everything she hasn't yet forgotten. Even as she's listing what I won't miss and what I will miss, making the final tally, Ephron reaches back to recount falling hard for a way of life in Journalism, A Love Story, and breaking up even harder with the men in her life in The D Word, a long-anticipated inheritance with entirely unanticipated results in My Life as an Heiress, and the evolution, a decade after she wrote and directed You've Got Mail, of her relationship with her inbox in The Six Stages of Email. All the while, she gives a candid, charming voice to everything women who have reached a certain age have been thinking, but have rarely acknowledged. Filled with insights and observations that ring true, you will enjoy this work, read by the author.
Everyone was judgmental about this, but not me. A month earlier, I'd found myself in a mall in Las Vegas when I saw a very pleasant-looking woman coming toward me, smiling, her arms outstretched, and I thought, who is this woman? Where do I know her from? Then she spoke, and I realized it was my sister Amy. You might think, well, how was she to know her sister would be in Las Vegas? I'm sorry to report that not only did I know, but she was the person I was meeting in the mall. All this makes me feel sad and wistful, but mostly it makes me feel old. I have many symptoms of old age aside from the physical. I occasionally repeat myself. I use the expression, when I was young. Often I don't get the joke, although I pretend that I do. If I go see a play or a movie for a second time, it's as if I didn't see it at all the first time, even if the first time was just recently. I have no idea who anyone in People magazine is. I used to think my problem was that my disc was full. Now I'm forced to conclude that the opposite is true. It's becoming empty. I have not yet reached the nadir of old age, the land of anecdote, but I'm approaching it. I know, I should have kept a journal. I should have saved the love letters. I should have taken a storage room somewhere in Long Island City for all the papers I thought I'd never need to look at again, but I didn't. And sometimes I'm forced to conclude that I remember nothing. For example, I met Eleanor Roosevelt. It was June 1961, and I was on my way to a political internship at the Kennedy White House. All the Wellesley Vassar interns drove to Hyde Park to meet the former First Lady. I was dying to meet her. I'd grown up with a photograph in our den of her standing with my parents backstage at a play they'd written. My mother was wearing a corsage, and Eleanor wore pearls. It was a photograph I always thought of as iconic, if I'm using the word correctly, which if I am, it will be for the first time. We were among the thousands of Americans, mostly Jews, who had dens, and in their dens, photos of Eleanor Roosevelt. I idolized the woman. I couldn't believe I was going to be in the same room with her. So what was she like that day in Hyde Park, you may wonder? I have no idea. I can't remember what she said or what she wore. I can barely summon up a mental picture of the room where we met her, although I have a very vague memory of drapes. But here's what I do remember. I got lost on the way. And ever since, every time I've been on the Taconic State Parkway, I'm reminded that I got lost there on the way to meet Eleanor Roosevelt. But I don't remember a thing about Eleanor Roosevelt herself. In 1964, the Beatles came to New York for the first time. I was a newspaper reporter, and I was sent to the airport to cover their arrival. It was a Friday. I spent the weekend following them around. Sunday night, they appeared on the Ed Sullivan Show. You could make an argument that the 60s began that night on the Ed Sullivan Show. It was a historic night. I was there. I stood in the back of the Ed Sullivan Theater and watched. I remember how amazingly obnoxious the fans were, the teenage girls who screamed and yelled and behaved like idiots. But how were the Beatles, you may ask? Well, you are asking the wrong person. I could barely hear them. I marched on Washington to protest the war in Vietnam. This was in 1967, and it was the most significant event of the anti-war movement. Thousands and thousands of people were there. I went with a lawyer I was dating. We spent most of the day in a hotel room having sex. I am not proud of this, but I mention it because it explains why I honestly cannot remember anything about the protest, including whether I ever even got to the Pentagon. I don't think I did. I don't think I've ever been to the Pentagon, but I wouldn't bet a nickel on it one way or the other.
Phew, we've packed a lot into this show. I hope you've enjoyed our time together, and I hope this new year brings you chapter after chapter of happiness. Now here's a New Year's resolution we should all put at the top of our list, making the time to spend a few hours each week with a good book. You deserve it. Thanks again to Erin James for our theme music. I know she's right at the top of my top 10 list of favorite blues artists.
Check out her music at erinjames.com. That's erinjames.com. I'm Elaine Charles, and I'm wishing you a very happy new year. See you next week at The Book Report.